Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Pat Johnson has been active in the Western Australian writing community for many years in the capacity of writer, creative, and in supporting the writing community through her work with the Fellowship of Australian Writers, WA branch. She migrated to Australia with her family of origin when she was just 18, and this episode begins with her recollections and impressions of that time, and then segues into a discussion on how this feeds into her creativity. The recording ends with a beautiful poem in honour of her daughter. I began by asking her how she would describe her identity.
I migrated to Australia when I was 18 with my family. And so all that time of growing up in another culture is very deeply embedded. And after that, there's another layer of Australian culture to which I adapted and enjoyed. But identity is very complex.
Sure is.
So I don't know what else I should say about that.
You are a creative person.
Yes, I like to write fiction and poetry, short stories. I have had some things published. I have spent a long time involved with the Fellowship of Australian Writers on the committee and working in admin and finally as president for a couple of years. So that was my main interest in my last 15, 20 years or so, was writing.
So you came to Australia from whereabouts? You came from the United States, didn't you?
Yeah, I came from New England, from Connecticut. My whole family came, which was two older brothers and myself and my parents.
And you'd been prompted to come here as a result of your father's experience, is that right?
Yes, my father was in the US Navy. He was stationed here. I'm not sure if he was in Perth. I know he was in Brisbane and he was fighting in the Coral Sea. But he loved Australia and he liked the culture and he liked the weather. About the war, like many people, he never talked about it. But he always wanted to come back. In Connecticut, the weather can be really rough all winter long. There's a lot of snow. There's a lot of trees covered in icicles and days when you can't get out of your house because you're snowed in. And I think that the good weather here was part of the attraction. But my mother, who had strong family connections in Connecticut, really didn't want to come, and it took him quite a long time to convince her to move.
Right. Did your father have family? Extended family in Connecticut as well? Or?
He did, but he wasn't as attached as my mother. It was just a personality thing, I think.
I guess the older that you migrate, the more embedded your identity is in your place of origin too. Although even, I think 18, you pretty much know who you are by then, don't you?
Yeah. I think that's true. I think after a certain age, it's much more difficult to navigate and be happy in a new place. You're just sort of still back in your old place, in your head.
So was there the opportunity to go back with family? Or
well, not really, because It was extremely expensive in those days to go back and forth, and I didn't go back for 30 years.
My countries were further apart in a way, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. My oldest brother went back after a year. He never wanted to come, really. He was also much more American, like my mother. But the rest of us pretty much stayed here, yeah.
Mm. So can you remember back to your first impressions and what you thought of how it felt when you first came?
Yeah, we came on a cargo ship, so there weren't very many passengers, and we sailed from New York through the Panama Canal and across to Tahiti and then into Brisbane Harbour and from there into Sydney Harbour. And we arrived just at the time of Anzac Day in April. So the first impressions of Brisbane and of Sydney was that it was very sunny. In Sydney, the harbour was very beautiful. When we disembarked in Sydney, we did feel a little out of place, and some of the expressions and language we didn't get. Even though we were lucky enough to be speaking English, it was still quite a different use of language, and the slang was very different. Yeah, we were on a learning curve.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess often if you come speaking English, there's an expectation perhaps from the other side that you're going to understand things in a certain way.
Yes.
And a lot of opportunity for missed communication, whereas if you're speaking a different language, maybe there's more concessions in a way.
Well, probably. I mean, and the English here was very English. It was very British at that time because it was 1970.
Yes.
So, yeah, what there was not Australian. A lot of people I've met have asked me what accent it is because it's not American and it's not Australian, and I don't suppose it's anything else. It's just kind of a hybrid of an accent. I wouldn't be sounding American after 50 years, I don't think.
No. But some people really do retain a very strong...
I think part of it was that I married an Australian.
Right. And I guess the sense of humour is quite different too. Do you see that? Or has that changed over time with more interactions between the countries?
That's a tough question.
Yeah.
Humour doesn't travel like courtesy expressions. They don't travel that well either.
Right.
They can cause a lot of misunderstandings.
Yes, and a lot of because a lot of humour is based on the opposites of what is intended. So yeah. Sometimes it can be quite hurtful if taken the wrong way, I suppose.
Yeah. And rhyming slang, that was something I'd never heard in the US, and it's very clever and I enjoy it, but I still hear things that I don't know what they are, and lots of people obviously do know what they are. I like Australian humour. I like watching shows, movies that are often they're Australian dramas, but they manage to get the humour in as well, whereas a lot of American dramas and other countries, if it's a drama, it's a drama. You know, there's no humour in there. So
quite intense.
Yeah, very intense. And I think that putting the humour in is a very Australian characteristic in real life, in difficult situations, so it really works well.
Yeah. You mentioned that there was a lack of an established American community in, and I guess America's that's a big word, isn't it? It's a big place.
I guess
there are communities.
Yeah.
But so when Australians go to England, for example, they might go to Earls Court, or that was the That was the idea, wasn't it? That people clustered together to give each other support.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't find that in Australia when you came here.
No, well, there just weren't very many Americans here. And the ones that were here tended to be businessmen and possibly their families, and they were transient. There definitely wasn't a real community that got together and did things together. Not at that time, anyway.
Mm. Were there people from, I know with your father's experience, because I know with a lot of servicemen often married local women, Australian women, and some went back to America and some stayed. Was there any sort of sense of community in terms of service people or that your father had?
No, there wasn't. No.
Nothing like that? Yeah. No. So your father, did he adjust fairly well to being here?
Yeah, he liked being here. He enjoyed it. Mm.
He'd had some prior experience, yeah. I suppose. Yeah. Yeah. So... And I'm going to talk about a sense of home here.
Oh, okay.
When, you know, even moving from one part of Australia to another part of Australia, there's a disruption of this sense of where you belong or where you feel settled. I guess it must be quite amplified for travelling to a whole different country across the world and a different culture and... Do you feel at home here now after all these years, or how long did it take you to feel that, or is there always a sense of disruption? What are your feelings on that?
Well, I think the feeling of home has a lot to do with being accepted, and it took me a couple of years to feel that way after I came, and I don't think of home as being a place particularly. It's more a sense of being and is attached to people that are important to you. And I don't know, perhaps that's something to do with moving, but I think my identity and my feeling of being at home is pretty internal.
Yeah. So linked to relationship and sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think, as far as your writing and your creativity goes, having these different experiences and this sense of movability, I guess, if you know, if it's not attached to a place, it's attached to people and relationships and things like that. Does that feed into your writing at all?
I think the writing is much more about ideas and expressing it through characters. And I think the travel just frees up that feeling that you can write about things. And that you can put yourself in someone else's shoes and look from their point of view.
Mm, yeah, which is, some people have said that it's one of the functions of fiction is to enable people to make those journeys into someone else's thoughts and feelings, and so it in a sense develops empathy and understanding of other points of view and that sort of thing. So your writing, can you tell us a little bit about your writing? You have done quite a lot of poetry. You did at first. Are you still writing a lot of poetry?
I do write poetry, but it comes in bursts and goes away again. So does fiction writing. Yeah, you have to be... It has to be there in your head for a while before it comes.
Comes out, yeah.
Before it comes out. I started when I was in my 50s. I did a postgraduate degree in creative writing at Curtin, and I had a wonderful poetry teacher called Maureen Gibbons. and she got the best out of everybody in the class, and I really enjoyed some of the formal structures of poetry. They really helped me to shape what I was trying to say.
Mm.
So, I don't know, I think my poetry's probably fairly serious and somber kind of writing.
It's been published quite a bit, hasn't it? Or...
Yeah, it's been published in different places here and there. Like, and I've had a few short stories published. I like writing sort of fantasy, but I dislike superheroes and rather write about real people who find themselves in strange situations.
Hmm. Mm. So, do you have female superheroes?
No. No, I dislike them. I dislike them. I think ordinary people are often quite heroic in their private lives, and no one knows what people have been through.
Incredibly heroic.
Yes, you know? Yes, incredibly ordinary people.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And that just being able to survive and to keep going and
yes.
is a super...
Superpower.
Superpower in itself, isn't it? You mentioned too when one of the things about changing countries from Connecticut to Australia and was that you felt freed up from tight expectations. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh yeah, the US is on the whole quite conservative. New England is even more conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Really very, very conservative. A very, very authoritarian outlook on life, and I don't know, but personally I didn't feel very free to make decisions about my life at that time, and opportunities weren't so available. When I came to Perth, you just had to walk through town and you could get a job. Or you could meet people, or you could find some new avenue to look at. Whereas that really didn't happen back home. You got set on a course, you were going to uni, or you were going into your father's business, or whatever. There just wasn't that feeling that you could go to another place and make a life there. It was more of a, I guess it was more insecure.
Is it something about the weather and being snowed in and that confinement? That's what I think of when you say that, of somehow being corralled into a certain way because of literally snowed in. And
I think that's really true. My mother used to tell me, you know, that in places where it was warm, you know, there was always bananas hanging on the tree. But in Connecticut, the squirrels had to put their nuts away for winter. And it was like,
well, that's
watch
metaphor,
out.
That's right.
So, yeah, that is, I think, quite a bit to do with it.
Yeah, it's interesting how it enters your psyche, the actual environment. And I've often thought that with singing, that you can hear where people come from the way they sing. So you get people that from Iceland or somewhere like that, there's a different kind of vocalization in the singing.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you looked at someone like Grummel, you know, from the part of the world where he is, it's a singing out of, you know, there's a something to do with the landscape that actually affects your voice and frees you.
And as an aside to that, there's very good reason to feel insecure in the US because the medical system is very expensive, and anybody who loses their job and goes on an unemployment benefit has it cut off after 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So you've really got to work it. Yeah. And when I was growing up, it was very, very common for parents to, or fathers, because mothers tended to be home, but it was very, very common for fathers to have two jobs. It just was a harder world.
Very hard working and not a lot of time for leisure, which doesn't free up your mind for being able to just relax and think of things and
to look around
at the world and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's interesting. So you know, there is a lot of pushback in the US from the news that we get here anyway about going to a health system that's paid for by the government. Is it, what do you think is behind that?
Well, I think there's a lot of people pushing for it, and there's a lot of people pushing against it, and it's very political.
To do with vested interests, perhaps.
And I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the health system. Like, I went back in the year 2001 for 2 years, and as soon as I said something about the health system, people would say, yes, but you can't choose your own doctor.
Oh, okay.
And that sort of thing, you know. So it's just a concept they're not used to.
Yeah.
And
I guess change for everyone, change is always involves a certain amount of risk. And
they see it as socialism or even communism.
Right, which are kind of very loaded terms, aren't they?
Aren't they? Yes, yeah.
Yeah. So when you saying with your writing, you like to write about ideas, do you have particular areas of, you know, pet areas that you like to look at? Probably off the topic a bit. I'm just interested.
I think people get sort of pushed into certain positions and they don't like where they end up, but it's happened step by step, and that's an interesting thing to look at step by step, because somewhere in there there's a place where you could say, no, I'm not doing it. But on the other hand, lots of times, almost all the time, people's motivations are good. So, yeah, I like to look at that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how you kind of get tied into something like this podcast.
Like prostitution is a good one to look at, because I think a lot of people end up there through, you know, sort of desperation, and it's not like it's their career choice.
It's really interesting to pick those things apart through fiction and writing and poetry as well, because there's a, I suppose we tend to jump to the easiest conclusion when you think about things like homelessness or prostitution or, you know, any number of things. Whereas actually, if you track back and you look at a person's life and you pick that, if you look at that in detail, you actually see those steps and you can actually stand back and watch that, which is a wonderful thing about reading.
And yeah, I totally agree.
And about writing as well, because as a writer, you have to examine those things in detail and you have to think about them and give yourself time to really work it out. And
And it does involve a lot of getting out of your head into somebody else's. You know, that's quite a big feat sometimes.
That's huge, isn't it? Because it's, in a way, you have to actually examine your own assumptions all the time.
And if you can, like, I know one time I I got into a really into a role of what I was writing about for a couple of hours, and I was in this other person's head and I was writing, and when it came to an end, I was so exhausted I went and slept for 2 hours. Wow. I was really, my brain didn't know what was happening.
You had to consolidate. You had to have a few drinks. I find, don't you, with the writing too, you have to be scrupulously honest with yourself when you know that you're faking it, or you're just taking an easy route instead of actually taking an honest route to saying things, because there are things, and there you've got social expectations too playing.
It's quite devastating, isn't it, to try and peel back and get to the actual truth. Oh my God.
Yeah, and it makes you quite vulnerable, I think, to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although I think it's good to be vulnerable.
I think so too. I think in some ways that's one of the things that is the gift, isn't it? That you're offering, in a sense, is that vulnerability, and because that's what is most interesting and makes us most human, in a sense.
Yeah, I agree. If you're not really willing to make an ass of yourself, you're never going to learn anything. You stick with whatever you think you know.
I used to do acting, and one of the things with that was that you basically have to be prepared to make a fool of yourself. I think the first time I went on stage I froze, and then I thought to myself, that was the best thing that ever happened, because in front of all these people, because I thought, well, it can only get better from here. So that was it helped. It helps, actually. I think once you've made a fool of yourself, you're okay, because you know that, well, it didn't kill me.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all right. So when you went back to America, and you said you went there for 2 years, what motivated you to do that? What was behind that?
Well, my daughter died. She was 24. And I stayed for a while, but I just needed a change, a big change, so that something so big that it would make me think about what I was doing, how I was surviving from minute to minute, because everything works differently. My brother was still there, so I went back, stayed with him for 2 years, and after a while I got a job, and I enjoyed it, So it was interesting in terms of how things had changed and not changed.
Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, if you live in Perth for a couple of years, you notice that there's buildings where buildings used to be, or, there's new this or new that. But I went back to our town where we grew up, it was exactly the same.
Oh, it hadn't changed that much.
It hadn't changed much. There's a bit of urban decay and a new shopping mall. But, apart from that, honestly, it was very, very similar to what it was. The old house was still there. The street was exactly the same. Everything.
Did it trigger a lot of memories for you? Did it kind of childhood memories?
Well, I wouldn't say so, because, you don't go back after 30 years and think it's going to be the same. Mm. And most of that stuff is not, it's more to do with the people, the childhood friends and all that sort of stuff.
So which, that changes.
Yeah.
Mm. Strangers there, but the setting was the same.
And
I guess that it's again, what you were saying about home being
The
people. Exactly. And what did you work at when you were there?
I worked for a nurses association, and like their professional body, doing admin. And yeah, well, it was a nice office. There was a lot of camaraderie. It was easy to live with my brother and go to work. The pay was abysmal. Like if I'd been having to rent an apartment or something, I wouldn't have been well off at all.
Mm.
But I guess people live with that all the time. It was, yeah.
Yeah, it seems to be quite, well, I went over there in 2017, I think, and just talking to taxi drivers or Uber mm-hmm. drivers and different people, and having three jobs is not unusual.
No. And there is a lot of resentment, which never was the case when I was growing up. It was a little bit more fair, the system.
Mm-hmm.
It's polarised more. There's a lot of people who work in checkouts or fast food or something like that that don't have good conditions, that don't have good pay. They're on their feet all day, and it's no surprise that they look very unhappy. A lot of them are extremely overweight because they can't afford good food. They get a dollar hamburger or something from McDonald's and they get enormous.
Mm.
Yeah, it's very tough on people, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are some good things about that American culture too, aren't there? With the, you know, the kind of determination and the kind of, there's a lot of strength in that working that hard and, you know, having that sort of ambition. There's a kind of...
There's a lot of good things about American culture, particularly, I think, their belief in democratic principles and freedom of speech and so forth. It's very strong.
Mm.
Mm.
And there's, because there's a lot of diversity as well, isn't there? So I guess
yes.
You've got that, all the different, probably, it's more multicultural in Australia, I think, do you think?
It's...
depends on where you go, I suppose.
Yeah, it depends on where you go a lot.
I guess, you know, because I went to New York first, and of course that's very multicultural. But, Connecticut, maybe?
Not so much, no. I think the really big cities have wonderful diversity.
Mm, yeah.
And also wonderful cultural activities and...
Yeah, opportunities to
yes.
for theatre and art
yeah.
and all sorts of things like that. Mm. Yeah, that's one of the really wonderful things about it. And the country's beautiful.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a beautiful country.
I think in Australia, you're not very supported by the natural environment. It's mostly dry and...
The harshness,
no,
isn't it?
No, productive. Yeah. Whereas in the US, the climate means you've got big trees everywhere and wonderful things like that. It's beautiful, but then you do have the winter to come with.
And you have the cold and the icicles and things
yes.
like that. Yeah.
I'm very happy that I migrated here. It's been... I think I've done probably more with my life here than I would have done.
If you'd stayed where you were.
Yeah, yeah. I think I might have been more put in a box.
There is something about the directness of having everything planned ahead and knowing where you're going that feels extremely confining. I guess it, you know, and I sometimes I think that plays into writing too, because you know, there are people who plan ahead and have a plot outlined and everything going in a particular direction, and you know, I guess that can lead to a very nicely structured piece of work, or there's people like myself, and I don't know about you. Where you just jump in and explore and find out where you're going as you go along, sort of thing.
Yeah, I like to think, what would this character do?
Yeah.
Not decide what they're going to do ahead of time. Just think, oh, this has happened and this person's X, Y, Z. Well, how would they react? And then you get an interesting plot, I think.
Yes, so every, I think that's right, every decision you make, it kind of, it's a bit like you were saying about with the poetry, how you've got a structure or the form gave you a certain amount of freedom to explore. So I guess each time you make a decision as you go along, that limits your options to what's but at the same time it helps you to become more creative. It gives you that it's like when you're swimming and you have a wall to push off.
Yes. And I should give a plug to WA Poets Inc. because they do a wonderful job. They have competitions and they do publish every year.
WA Poets Inc.
Yeah.
Whereabouts are they situated?
Well, they have an office on Barrack Street.
Right.
Upstairs. They have a room. After many years of not having any sort of headquarters, they've got that through some combination of government grants, and they do a very thorough job, and they have a poetry event every Saturday afternoon at the Moon in Northbridge,
right.
And lots of other things happening.
So
I've been published by them a few times.
Right, so they actually do have a publishing arm as well as the performance poetry?
Yeah, they do. They're very... There's a lot of good poets in WA. It's kind of a flowering time for poets at the moment.
Mm. And that is a nice event at the Moon Cafe, isn't it?
It's lovely.
Where people come on a Saturday afternoon and just sit around and drink beer or coffee and you have an open mic session, is that right? And a featured poet?
Yeah, there's usually a featured poet. And then there's open mic for people who want to read their own poetry or someone else's. But it's very relaxed and it's very original and fresh. It's not like going to the movies or going to the pub. It's sort of more real.
I've been a couple of times and I think it seems to me like quite a safe space for people to read some fairly confronting poetry sometimes. And there's quite a wide range, isn't there?
There is, and yeah, people do feel safe. It's a very supportive environment.
Yeah.
I think poets are sensitive souls, so they probably know not to be critical and just, you know, appreciate what's happening.
And anyone can rock up there on a Saturday afternoon. What time is it? 2 o'clock?
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock to four. Mm,
yeah.
Open mic events, such as those offered at the Moon Cafe in Northbridge, enable word artists not only to share their creative endeavours in a warm, collegial environment, but they bring the art form to members of the public who are looking for something of value to do on a Saturday afternoon. I asked Pat if we might conclude this interview with one of her poems.
I tried to save her, but the baby fell. I tried to hold her, but did not hold her well. I tried to love her, but my love was ill. I tried to keep her, but she had her will. My baby fell and broke apart her life, and in my heart there lay a glittering knife. The knife has rusted there and still remains. My heart has bled and scarred and loves her just the same.
Thanks to Pat for agreeing to do this interview, and to you for listening. Until next time.